Okay, shall we begin? So there are a few logistical things here at the beginning of class. One thing is we'll keep this up for a few class periods, and it'll take a while for everybody to get accustomed to it. Then it'll be automatic, no problem. But you need to, in general, sit near your TAs. Part of the reason for that is because we will have our Twitter card question today, and you'll need to hand that into your TA, and it's just better if you're in the right geographical area. So up here is Luke's section. Luke, where are you? He's in the back, but he'll be here in a minute. Over here on this section is Katie's section. This is Katie right there. You hand into her. Right behind Katie's section on this side is Donish's section. Are you here, Donish? Not around yet. Behind that is Amy's section. Amy, see her waving right there? That's who you hand it into. So Luke is now here. Luke, you hand into Luke right there. Behind his section is Anna's section. Hand into Anna right there. Behind that is Rebecca's section. Hand into Becca right there. Okay, another little bit of logistics. I mentioned last time that we will have campus tours on Saturday. We will not have class next Tuesday. If you come to class next Tuesday, you're going to be very lonely because everybody else will have figured out that we do not have class next Tuesday. Instead, we are doing campus tours on Saturday, and this tells you the times of those. Those are your unique numbers and your TAs, and they'll be running all day long. If somebody has some really urgent thing that they need to do between 1:30 and 2:30, and that's the time they're scheduled, no problem, just go to one of the other ones. It won't really matter. It's the same every time, but if possible, it's good if you can go to the one that is designated for your discussion section. Okay, two other tiny little logistic things. One is remember that if you did not get the four handouts from last time, they're up here at the front, and you definitely need to have those four handouts. Very, very important. The second thing is one thing on those handouts that I changed last time. The first test is not going to be on February 26th, as it says there. Instead, it's going to be on February 24th. That's a change. Test number one is on February 24th. I think that's all the logistical things. Okay, this is one of my favorite lectures of the whole semester because we're just beginning to talk here about architecture and society. And I'm going to give a definition of what I think architecture is. And it's not a definition that you're going to find in the dictionary, but it's going to be the working definition that we use for architecture through this semester. And I'm going to say that architecture is the physical embodiment of who we are as individuals and who we are collectively as a culture. It is the way that we make tangible and physical our values, our interests, our character, our direction. It is a physical embodiment of who we are as individuals and who we are collectively as a culture. Now let me give you a few examples. So let's imagine that UT had this very, very liberal policy about its dormitories. And they said that day one you can go into your dorm and you can fix it up any way you want. And let's say you as a freshman get assigned to Jester and you've got this little dorm room and you can do anything you want with it. And you decide to paint it all jet black. Walls, ceilings, doors, everything painted jet black. And you take that little prison window and you get a blackout shade so that you erase all natural light or any view to the outside. And then you get yourself this badass zebra rug and you put it on the floor. And on your bed, you get this black, luxuriant fur bedspread and you put that on the bed. You put a few rock posters on the wall. You get one of those disco balls that have all the little mirrors in it, and you shine lasers up at it so it all sparkles like crazy. You get some amazing speakers, just the greatest sound system, and you play it at top volume. And so say then I come in, knock on your dorm room, you open the door, and I walk in. I will get an impression of who you are by that dorm room. How could I not? Of course I would. I would get some sense of who you are as an individual, because that room becomes an embodiment, a physical embodiment of who you are as an individual. Let's say, by contrast, you took the same Jester dorm room and you painted it kind of a pale, sweet pink, sort of like cotton candy pink. And you put really lacy, ruffly curtains on the window, and you have a matching bedspread that's also lacy, ruffly bedspread. And you take you get a little pin board made out of cork, and you put it on the wall, and you take all your corsages from your prom, and you take pictures of you and your friends at the beach and having sleepovers. And you have all of your stuffed animals from your entire childhood, and you put all your stuffed animals on the bed. Likewise, if I walked in, I would get an impression of who you are as an individual. And it would be very, very different. Now, I might not say anything, I might not comment, but I would definitely get an impression of who you are as an individual, because we all know, in our back of our head, we know that architecture is a physical embodiment of who we are as individuals. And if someone makes their space like that, it says something about who they are. Okay, let's jump to a larger scale. Imagine that 10 years out of school, no, let's say right out of school, you graduated from UT, and let's say you were majoring in education, elementary education, and you get a really good job in Lockhart, Texas, sweet little town about 30 miles from Austin. And you're making a reasonable income, and it's dirt cheap to live in Lockhart, and you're able to afford to rent this little house. And it's a little bungalow house on kind of a big lot. It's got a big front porch. It's got a bunch of pecan trees in the yard. It's right near the downtown and the square there. It's close enough so you can walk to the elementary school where you teach. You can also walk to church on Sunday morning. You can also walk to a little grocery store and get basic groceries. And you enjoy small town life, and you decide you're going to grow a little garden, so you till your soil and you plant some fruits and vegetables in there, and you in the fall you collect all the pecans from those trees, and you sit on your porch and you shell pecans, so you'll have the pecans for the rest of the year. And when you sit on that porch, maybe you're doing your email on that porch, or maybe you're shelling pecans, or sometimes you even take the TV and watch it on the porch. And your neighbors come by, they're little kids that live across the street, and they like to hang out, and you kind of enjoy teasing them and playing with them. And through the neighbor kids and through your church and through the school, you get to know everybody in town. It's a small town. You see the same people over and over at the grocery store and, at church. And if you live in Lockhart, Texas, there in that physical environment, that house, that space around the house, that neighborhood, that community, that town, in 10 years, that will have an impact on you. You will become a certain kind of person because you're in a milieu that lets you make friends in a certain way, that gives you certain daily activities, certain patterns of everyday life that will shape who you are. By contrast, imagine that you graduate from UT, and let's say you major in elementary education, but you decide to move to New York City, and you get yourself a job in a kind of low-income neighborhood school, really tough, tough school. You move into a neighborhood that's kind of transitional. It used to be an old warehouse neighborhood, and now it's gotten to be a little bit artsy, but you can't afford that cool place, so you're living in this walk-up, and you're like on the fifth floor. There's no elevator in the building. It's slightly illegal. You have a tiny little apartment, kind of just like a little cooktop and a tiny little half fridge there. And you're you're kind of struggling. Your apartment's really small. There's not much natural light coming in. There's just a building right across from your only window. But, oh, man, you're in the city, and it's incredibly dynamic and vibrant, and you just love walking out there and feeling the energy of the city and all the cosmopolitan diversity of the people that are there. If you live in that place for 10 years, and instead of hearing the birds singing when you wake up in the morning like you might have in Lockhart, you get accustomed to waking up to the dumpster being emptied in the street outside and the noise in the city awakening every morning. And you get a pattern of relationships. You don't have a lot of really good friends you see over and over, but you have all this mass of humanity that you're coming in contact with in a certain way. If you lived in that neighborhood in New York for 10 years, that would make you a certain kind of person. And it'd be very different from the kind of person you might be in Lockhart, Texas. Now, I don't have to. You know that intuitively. I don't have to convince you of that. Where you live, the physical environment, how you manage that, has an enormous impact on your life. Now, I always love it when someone who's famous and respected validates something I believe in, so I can use authority to convince you of that and not just take my word for it. And in this case, there's huge authority, Winston Churchill, who laid down a dictum in this regard. So Churchill is speaking to Parliament right after World War II. World War II was devastating to England, and in particular devastating to London. The Germans had bombed mercilessly in what was called the Blitz, and this is what London looked like at the end of World War II. Actually, I was in London a year or so ago, and a friend had this enormous folio book that just looked block by block at what the damage was in World War II. It was like, you know, totally devastated, you know, substantially destroyed or untouched. And it was phenomenal. The entire city was just devastated by the bombing. So England is on the winning side in World War II, but they've got this devastation. So Winston Churchill goes before Parliament, and he gives a speech to Parliament where he's asking them to appropriate the money to rebuild London. And they don't have any money. They spent all their money on the war, and they borrowed to the hilt. But still, he says, we have to spend this money rebuilding the city. And in that speech, there was the following quote. We shape our buildings. Thereafter, our buildings shape us. We will not be a great culture in the future if we don't rebuild London. Because we shape our buildings, and then they determine what kind of culture we're going to be. So if this is so powerful at the level of an individual, what kind of person you become, if it's so important at the level of a culture that you can't be a great culture unless you build a great city like London, why is it we don't talk about this more? Why is it we don't learn about this in schools? Why don't we make it a big political issue? Why is it this is not more a forefront notion in our culture? And actually, I think the explanation is pretty simple, really. The problem is that the impact of we have to understand how much of our activity is based on this unconscious part of our brain. And that's where architecture lives. It's in the unconscious part of your brain. Let me give you a couple of examples. So there's a guy named Roger Ulrich, and he is a social scientist, and he studies hospitals. He studies behavior in hospitals. And he did a study, and he used a hospital where there was a double-loaded corridor. A corridor down the center, there were exactly the same hospital rooms on one side and the same hospital rooms on the other side. There was just one difference. In the hospital rooms on one side, 20 feet outside the window was a brick wall. So you looked out from your bed, you look out this window, and it's a brick wall. On the other side of the corridor, you look out your window, and it's a beautiful garden with big trees and flowers and children playing and birds singing and a beautiful, beautiful view out that side. And so he wanted to figure out, does that difference in environment affect the healing of the people in that hospital room? So he charted over a period of time two things. One is how long were hospital stays for the same illness? And the other was how often did the patient require pain medication? So basically he's looking at how quickly are they recovering and how much are they feeling pain and needing medication. And so they did that for several years, and then he looks at the data, and there's a huge difference between the side that looks into the brick wall and the side that looks into the garden. The side that looked into the brick wall had to stay a day and a half longer in the hospital on average than the people who were looking out to the courtyard. And they needed pain medication at three times the level of the people who were looking out to the courtyard. Now, this was because the unconscious brain of the people looking out to the courtyard was getting comfort, was getting serenity, was getting refreshment, was getting well-being through the physical environment, and it made them feel less pain, and it made them heal faster. And the people on the other side were getting none of that, and it made them feel the pain more cogently, and it made them heal more slowly. This is the unconscious power. Now, it wasn't the nurses were saying, damn, you got screwed. You know, if you were on the other side of the hall, you'd be recovering a lot faster because you'd be looking at the courtyard. No, they don't know that, but it's unconsciously that's working on your recovery as a patient. Another example, there's a woman named Lisa Hishong. We'll actually read a book she wrote in the second part of the course. Lisa Hishong did a study of schools in California, commissioned by the sort of agency that runs schools in California. And they were looking at the impact of classrooms on student performance. And in particular, they were looking at one thing, which was the amount of daylight in the classroom. So is it important to have a large window, a medium-sized window, a tiny window? Do students learn better if they don't have the distraction of looking out the window? You know, what is the impact of the size of the window on student learning? So she looked at three different kinds of schools. The first of these schools had tiny little windows, very, very little window, and very little natural daylight that came in through the window. And then she also looked at some schools that had medium-sized windows, maybe even two medium-sized windows in a classroom. And then she looked at some schools that had floor-to-ceiling glass, maybe even also had a skylight, lots and lots of connection to the outdoors. And then she tracked over a period of years student performance in those rooms, in both math and in reading. These were elementary school kids. And she found over a period of time that the students' performance in both math and reading on standardized tests improved faster in the rooms with more daylight. In the rooms with a medium-sized window is better than in the rooms with a tiny window. And the rooms with floor-to-ceiling glass or maybe even a skylight, they actually had substantially higher improvement in their test scores when the kids were learning in that room. Now, yeah, question.
Well, you know, that's possible. But I think, I mean, she's a social scientist, and she's trying to equilibrate for that. So that she's doing it in some wealthy school districts and some not so wealthy school districts. And there's not actually a one-to-one correspondence. The poor school districts don't do little windows. And so she's trying to equilibrate for that. She's a smart lady. And in the end, it was very clear that when you had larger windows, more exposure to daylight, the students did better in their performance. And this was just change of performance. So it wasn't that they performed higher, than another school. It was just, what was the difference when they were in that classroom from what they performed at the beginning of going in that classroom and when they came out? Now, that actually has a scientific basis, because our bodies produce a chemical called serotonin. Serotonin is a natural antidepressant. It's sort of like Ritalin. I mean, it stimulates you. It's a stimulus. And it makes you more alert and makes you more accepting. So it turns out that daylight makes the body produce serotonin at a higher rate than if there is no daylight. Artificial light has some impact of that sort, but it's really daylight that stimulates the production of serotonin. And, we know that from a lot of Nordic countries that have very little daylight because they have very short days in the wintertime. They have a big problem with depression, and sometimes they give light therapy to people in those instances because they're just not producing serotonin. So if you have a lot of daylight and those little kids are producing lots of serotonin and it is an antidepressant, it's a stimulus, they pay attention, they're more alert, then of course they're going to learn better. So there actually is a physiological explanation for why that works. So it's actually understandable why the physical environment has this big impact on things like healing or things like how we learn. I think this, and this is why I think it's so important for everybody to understand architecture, because it can be the difference of whether you actually have a happy life or you have a boring life, or you have a stupid life, or you have an interesting life, if you're controlling the physical environment around you. Whether you have a healthy life, whether you learn quicker or you learn slower, how your kids learn or don't learn, or how they're healthy or not healthy, all these things can be affected by the physical environment. So I have this friend who he's been my best friend for pretty much my whole life. We grew up together and went to the same school and were always just really, really tight. Then we went to different undergraduate schools, but then it turned out for graduate school we both ended up back in Boston. So I was going to graduate school in architecture at MIT. He was going to law school at Harvard. And so we lived a block away from each other, and we reconnected as college students. And it was just fantastic. And we were, again, just best friends. So then after he graduated and I graduated, I stayed in Boston and taught at MIT and practiced there. He moved to Washington. That was his dream. He's a freaking lawyer, and he loves politics. And, Washington is lawyer political haven. So he moved to, and he got just a dream job, great law firm. And so he moves down there. We were really poor as college students. He kind of, still had that mentality. So he gets this place on Capitol Hill, which was convenient, but it was kind of a bad neighborhood. Now it's a shishy neighborhood, but back then it was a pretty bad neighborhood. So he calls me up. I don't know, maybe he's been there 2 months or something. And he calls me up and said, I just don't get it. I am so depressed. And I've never been depressed in my life. It's just not like me. And it wasn't like him. I mean, he was a very upbeat, positive guy. But he said, I can hardly get out of bed in the morning to go to work. I'm just depressed. So, he calls me 2 weeks later, same story, 2 weeks later, same story. And finally I said, look, let me drive down to Washington, spend the weekend, try to cheer you up. So I drove down to Washington, picked up the key at his law firm, and I was going to go and go to his apartment, fix dinner, be ready when he got home from work. So I go to this apartment building, and oh my God, number one, it's a creepy neighborhood. It's totally creepy. And then it's one of these like walk-up buildings, maybe like four stories, and he was on the top floor, no elevator. You walk in, and the stairwell smelled like pee. Ooh, creepy. And the carpet was all filthy and smelly, and just, and then you had to walk up four flights of stairs through this nasty stairwell. And finally, I get to his apartment, and I open the door, and the landlord had completely repainted the apartment before he moved in. But the way that he had repainted it was just to spray paint everything beige. Beige walls, beige ceilings, beige kitchen cabinets, beige paint on the doorknob, on the hinges. I mean, they just took spray paint and just spray painted everything. Didn't mask anything out, no care whatsoever, just haphazard painted. You know, really awful. I go in there, he has no furniture. I mean, he's got a mattress on the floor. All his stuff is still in boxes. All his books are sitting around in stacks. Go to the kitchen, you open the refrigerator, there's like some half-spoiled milk and nothing else, just empty. And so I immediately go to the grocery store, buy some stuff, start to put together a little bit of dinner. He comes home and I said, "You're an idiot. The reason you're so depressed is because you live in a freaking depressing place. You know, you've got to get out of this apartment. This is horribly depressing." And he said, "Oh, Larry, you're just an architect. You know, you think that's important. I spend all my time at work. I don't even hang out here much. And I just come here to crash. It isn't important. I don't know what it is making me depressed, but that's not it." So, you know, we hang out for the weekend. I go back to Boston. He keeps calling me. Same story. I'm depressed. He had a 6-month lease on this place. And I said, finally, "Dude, I'm going to come down there and we're going to find a new place for you to live because you can't stay where you are." And at that point, he's not resistant anymore. He's weakened. And so we go down there and we look around and we find this. For one thing, he's making a good salary. He's a freaking rich lawyer. So he's got some disposable income, and I convince him to let go of some of it. And we find a pretty nice place that was, in a townhouse. And he's on the bottom floor, and there's like a living room, dining room, kitchen that opens out to a little garden in the back. And the garden has a big tree in it, and it's paved with little red bricks. And there's a little table and chairs out in the garden under the big tree. And it's in a really nice neighborhood that, you know, feels safe. And so we go and buy him some furniture, which he had none of. So I convinced him to buy this one leather chaise lounge, gorgeous piece of furniture. And it was like for him, "Oh, my God, this is so much money. I can't spend this much money." And look, dude, you got some money. Spend it. You know, it's a really great chair. He still has that chair today, all these years later. Great chair. We buy him a few nice plants. We put some stuff up on the wall. You know, we just kind of fix it up. And then, you know, I go back to Boston. So a couple of weeks later, I get a phone call on a Sunday. And it's Sunday evening. And he said, "Oh, man, Larry, you won't believe. Today was just a great day. I got up this morning. And, you know, just a couple of blocks from my house, there's that little tennis court area and park. So I invited a couple of friends from work, and we went out and we played doubles tennis there for a couple of hours this morning. And then, you know, there's that cool little bakery just on the corner down from my house. We went over there and we got some croissants and some orange juice, and we brought it back to the house, and we sat on the table under that big tree, and we, you know, read the Washington Post, and we talked about politics. And then later in the afternoon, we went inside and watched the Redskins game on TV, and man, you know, I feel like I'm making some friends. I feel like, you know, I've really kind of, you know, Washington's feeling good. You know, I'm not depressed anymore." And I said, "You freaking idiot. You're an idiot. You're supposed to be this smart guy, but you're an idiot. because you're not managing the physical environment in your life. And it makes a huge difference in whether you're depressed or whether you're happy. Now, all of you know, in your heart of hearts, you probably had an experience, at least a little bit like that, where if you're not in a physical environment that is positive, it's a real detriment to your life. Now, I'm going to make an argument here in the next few minutes that architecture is this pervasive thing in the world. It's every aspect of everything we do in our lives. And that other disciplines, it's embedded in other disciplines. It's a subtext of so many other parts of life. And if we don't understand it, we don't understand the world. And if we do understand it, it's a key to a lot of what human behavior is about. So I'm going to make the argument that architecture is a subtext of many different disciplines that we enjoy or that we experience in life. The first one is literature. And for many years in this class, I would talk about Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, because pretty much everybody in high school had to read Great Expectations. Now it turns out I don't think that many people read Great Expectations anymore. But the point I was trying to make was, here's Charles Dickens, who is this great author, and really what Charles Dickens does better than anything else is he puts you in a place vicariously. He describes a place, and you as the reader, if you're doing deep reading, and you're really reading in it, you imagine yourself in that place. And that is very much a part of his storytelling. You cannot divorce it from his storytelling. It's super important to him. And that's not true just of Charles Dickens. It's true of Ernest Hemingway. It's true of pretty much any great author. But a couple of semesters ago, a student in this class said, you know, stop using Charles Dickens as an example. We don't read Great Expectations anymore. He said, but what we all have read is Harry Potter books. So this is what he wrote to me in an email. He said, I know it's trivial and does not compare with the example of Great Expectations, but Harry Potter does exactly what you're talking about. Harry lives the first 10 years of his life in a broom closet and has to scrunch up his feet in order to sleep at night. The rest of his aunt and uncle's house where he lives is uncomfortably sterile. The reader automatically feels sympathy for Harry. His best friend Ron Weasley's house is the complete opposite. Delightfully homey, a bungalow-looking three-story-high rickety old house that is much lived in. The kitchen is constantly in a flurry of activity and their garden gnomes running amok in the garden. The reader identifies with this and wants this rough love atmosphere for Harry. Then Hogwarts, the school itself, is enormous and intimidating on the outside, although it's actually very homey. The portraits on the wall have their own personality and talk to the students. There are trick staircases and a multitude of shortcuts. The dorms have low light, high ceilings, and squashy armchairs. The ceiling in the great hall is bewitched to match the sky outside. In short, this school is a paradise, offering both great protection, but not at the mercy of personalization. Yeah, this guy got it. That when you read a book, so often it's about architecture. The story is being told about through architecture. And you understand who Harry Potter is because you imagine how it would be to grow up in that sterile environment of his parents' house. And you understand how amazing it is to go to Hogwarts when there's this glorious environment that is funny and mysterious and quirky and friendly and powerful all at the same time. That's how architecture is a subtext of something like literature. And we can't really understand literature, we can't actually write literature without understanding this subtext of architecture. Okay, if you get it with literature, let's think for a moment about drama, theater. So, of course, they have sets in theater. That's architecture. That is somebody designing a physical environment to reinforce the story that's being told. And the set's incredibly important. It is the unconscious part of theater. It's not like the people on the stage are saying, look at how lavish this set is. That's meant to tell you I'm rich. No, we just know that. It's the subtext. We read it immediately. And we know that person's rich because they're in this lavish environment. Someone like Shakespeare, the ultimate drama guy, totally gets this. And he's very explicit in his notes of how the sets are to be done for his plays and how the actors are to inhabit those sets. So, for example, in Romeo and Juliet, which I know all of you read in high school, there is the balcony scene. Okay, it's already architectural term, the balcony scene. And this is where Romeo and Juliet have kind of been eyeing each other at this big party, and they get smitten. And so then, but their families are warring and have this feud going on. So Juliet goes back with her family, Romeo goes back with his family. Then Romeo sneaks out of his house, and he goes to Juliet's house. Juliet is in her bedroom upstairs. There's a balcony outside her bedroom. Romeo is down in the woods in the garden down below, and he gets Juliet's attention. She comes out on the balcony, and they have this conversation. Now, you cannot understand that conversation if you don't understand the physical environment where they are. Romeo is vulnerable. He's in the wilds. He's in alien territory. Juliet is at home. She's in her bedroom. She's completely safe. Romeo is down below in the subservient position. Juliet is up high and looking down on him. There is this wonderful interaction between these two 15, 16-year-old kids where Juliet, the girl, is totally in control. And it's a really strong gender message in Romeo and Juliet, the degree to which Juliet is in control of that romantic relationship. And it's reinforced, it's established very strongly in the set, in the architecture that is a part of that theater. And you don't understand, you can't deeply understand that play without understanding that gender position that is given by the physical environment. Okay. If it's a subtext of literature and it's a subtext of theater, let's talk a minute about film. Much of what we call special effects in film are in fact what I would call architecture in film. It is this environment that you're placed in vicariously as you experience the film. And we're going to look at three very famous films and look at the way that the directors have used the physical environment to help us understand what's going on through architecture. So in The Wizard of Oz, very famous early film, at the beginning of that film, we find Dorothy in Kansas, where she grows up. The film is in black and white at that point, and she's on a farm in Kansas. And it's slow, and it's boring, and it's stupid, and the people around her are ordinary, and she is so bored. And then the tornado comes, lifts her house up, and plops her and Toto and the house down in Munchkin Land. And immediately the film goes to color instead of black and white, and we have all these munchkins around. And we have a physical environment that is bright, yellow, green, blue, purple, and the houses are, you know, these kind of cartoony, yellow, green, purple, little miniature houses. And there's a yellow brick road connecting all of those houses together. And immediately we know we're in a fantasy. Something crazy is going on here, where our whole mindset is changed when we go to Munchkin Land. And then there's the whole discussion with the Munchkins and, you know, welcome you to Munchkin Land and all that stuff. And then Dorothy goes off on this travel through the yellow brick road to try to find the Wizard of Oz and get back to Kansas. So along the way, she meets three cohorts. And each of the cohorts is met in a different architectural setting, a different place. And the place tells you who this person is. So first she's going along there. It's a bright sunny day. There are cornfields around. There's a yellow brick road. It's cheerful. It's happy. It's carefree. And we meet the scarecrow, who is cheerful and happy and carefree and hasn't got a brain. We meet him in the perfect place where you just don't need any thought or brain at all. Everything's just good. And that's who the scarecrow is. And then the yellow brick road starts winding and twisting, and we start getting big trees around, and there's all this moss hanging, and it's getting dark and kind of creepy, and you can't see around the corner. It's a little scary. And then we meet the cowardly lion, and he doesn't have any courage. We know who this person is by this physical environment that we're placed in the film. And then when she meets the Tin Man as well, and they begin to take the route together in the slide on the left, they turn the corner, they see this big vista. Dorothy turns to the other three and says, "Whoa, the wizard must be a great and powerful man to live in a city like that." And you see the Emerald City. How do we know who the wizard is? We just see his architecture. We see where he lives, and we know exactly who he is. And then they go into the city, and they go into the palace, and they go down the walkways, and they go past the horse of a different color, and finally they get to meet the wizard. And this is the room on the right where they meet the wizard. And it's huge, tall ceilings, and it's echoing acoustics, and it's somber and scary and intimidating. Who is the wizard really? He's a funny little guy behind a curtain in the room. What makes the wizard powerful? It's the architecture. It's the room. It's the feeling you have with the sound and the space and the scale. All of those things intimidate you. The filmmaker knows that the way you convey deep, rich emotions, feelings, qualities is through architecture in an unconscious way. He doesn't have to say it. He can make you feel it. And when you feel it deeply, subliminally like that, it can be more powerful than if he said the message in words. So filmmakers know that. Another example would be another classic film, Gone with the Wind. We just had a huge exhibition of Gone with the Wind in the Harry Ransom Center right next door here over the last 6 months. Anybody go see that exhibition? Okay, that's good. It was a great exhibition. It's an amazing, amazing landmark film. But it also is so much about architecture. So in the slide on the left, this is Scarlett O'Hara, age 18. They're about to have a party. She's in her home, Tara, this nice antebellum mansion. We know a lot about the upbringing of Scarlett O'Hara just by seeing where she grew up. So Tara it's a really nice house. She's clearly from an affluent family. It's not a huge, pretentious house. It's a very sweet, very pleasant, very nice house. And her childhood was very sweet and very pleasant and very nice. And she had wonderful friends and family. And she's kind of a carefree girl because she grew up in this place that was very pleasant and nice and comfortable and homey. We know all about Scarlett by experiencing Tara. And then the Civil War hits, and she's poor, and she's starving, and she's scratching and clawing her way out, and she becomes ruthless. And she marries Rhett Butler because he's got money. And then the war is over, and he's a scalawag, and he's making all this money and taking advantage of people. And they're rich, rich, rich. And they move to Atlanta, and they build this house in Atlanta on the slide on the right. And this house in Atlanta is totally different than Tara. This is a screw you, I'm rich house. Let me show you how rich I am. I am so rich, I can squash you like a bug. And I am never going to be poor again. I am in control here. You look at the scale of that balustrade. Wow, and all this fancy lights and crystal. And, it's about saying, I'm rich and I'm powerful and I'm here to stay. And that's what that house is about. And you know, it's not sweet and charming and pleasant. It's a screw you, I'm rich house. And that's who Scarlett O'Hara is now. She's a screw you, I'm rich bitch. And the message is really clear in the architecture. Take another classic film, Star Wars. So in one of the three original Star Wars trilogies, we have Luke Skywalker trying to gain the power of the Force. And he wants to become a Jedi warrior, and so he's going to be trained in the power of the Force. And he expects that he's going to go to study under this Jedi master, and he's expecting some, I don't know, maybe military, very prestigious training situation. And instead, his aircraft crashes on the planet of Dagobah, and he encounters his Jedi master, who is Yoda, in the slide on the left. And we are told a story here about what is the power of the Force. Is the power of the Force might makes right? I'm strong, I'm bold, I'm powerful, I'm dominant. No. The power of the Force is about this mucky, swampy, nasty, very, very modest planet. And this quirky, idiosyncratic little Jedi master. And the power of the Force is inside you, deep inside you. It's not something that's external. It's not something you force on other people. It's not might makes right. And we know that by the physical environment where he's getting his Jedi training and the place where his Jedi master Yoda lives. That is so different than the kind of power that is exemplified by Darth Vader and the Death Star in the slide on the right. That is might makes right. Huge scale. Very steely and strong and massive and overpowering and overwhelming. That's another kind of power. But the whole story of Star Wars is about different kinds of power. Inner power, external power, force or right. And it's exemplified by those physical environments. Again, you cannot imagine filmmaking without architecture as a subtext that's communicating so much of what that film is about. How many of you have seen Boyhood, the movie that's out now? Oh, man, you guys have got to get out more. Boyhood just won Best Picture, Golden Globes, made by director Richard Linklater, who's an Austinian. Lives here in Austin, and a lot of it was filmed here in Austin, in Houston, in some small towns between here and Houston. But this is about a little kid growing up. It's a very, very, it's a great film. But it's about ordinary people, and the places he chooses to film that are the most ordinary places. You go into this living room where this woman lives with her two kids, and you can see the mismatched furniture, and you can see that she's trying to have a party, and there aren't enough places to sit, and you know, the kind of uncomfortable. And you feel this, you know, this poor woman doesn't quite have her life together. And because, you know, you feel it in the physical environment. The messages are so much created by the physical environment. Okay, so literature, drama, film, other areas that likewise. Architecture is a subtext. So I would say that music is something that just depends heavily on architecture. So any good musician will tell you that their craft, whether their music sounds good, depends heavily on the acoustics of the room. I can be a fantastic pianist, but if I'm playing the piano in a room that doesn't have the right reverberation, the piano doesn't sound right. So there is this intrinsic connection between music and architecture and the physical environment it's in. I would say that there are whole genres of music, like, let's say, Dixieland jazz, that really came out of a physical environment. It was born in the French Quarter in New Orleans, and it was born in clubs that had a certain ambiance. It was kind of hot, sticky environment. You had that ceiling fan going walkada, 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 walkada. You had, a slightly downtrodden quality to the French Quarter. A music came out of that that has the rhythms, that has the feeling, that has the kind of bluesy, downtrodden quality of that neighborhood of the French Quarter. There are plenty of people who would say you could never get Dixieland jazz out of Ames, Iowa. Not going to happen. It had to come out of New Orleans because of a place that engendered a culture that made that music. Definitely, politics is interwoven with architecture. In the, 16th century, there was a pope in Rome named Sixtus V. Sixtus V, when he was a little kid, he had been a messenger boy in the church, and he had worked for the cardinals and the priests, carrying messengers from one church to another in Rome. And at that time, Rome was this medieval city that had twisty, windy streets and was difficult to negotiate, hard to find your way around in. You can see just all these little wiggly streets going everywhere and not much order to it. It was built around seven hills, and basically they were just trying to negotiate the hills with those streets. And then in the midst of that, they would build these badass churches, and really amazing churches. And so he knew the whole city and had experienced that as a kid. When he got to be pope, he said, I'm going to make Rome the holy city. I'm going to make it a place that everyone in the world thinks is all about religion. I'm going to make religion dominant in Rome. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to cut a few long, straight streets that connect all of the major churches. So when you walk out and you look down a street, you see at the end of it Santa Maria Maggiore, or you see San Lorenzo, or you see Santa Croce, or you see the two churches at Piazza del Popolo, or you look and you see St. Peter's. But I'm going to cut these long straight streets. They're going to be the major avenues, the major passageways in the city, and they're always going to terminate on a great religious monument. And people will know that Rome is all about the church. So at great expense and great disruption, they cut all these streets through Rome. And to this day, we call it the Holy City. If he wanted politically to make religion the most important thing in Rome, the way he did it was revise the city so people saw Rome as the holy city. 200 or so years later, we have Louis XIV in France doing much the same thing. Louis XIV got to be king when he was a very, very young man, and he decided at a certain point he wanted to make the monarchy in France the premier monarchy in Europe. And he figured out the way he was going to do that was he was going to build the best, most amazing, most impressive palace in Europe. And then he would invite all the crowned heads of Europe to be entertained at this palace. And they would come there and they would think, holy moly, wow, they're way ahead of us in France. Look at this amazing, wow, they're rich and they have great taste and they're very erudite. And so he hires a great architect, a great landscape architect, a great interior designer, and together they make the palace at Versailles right here. They build a whole city of Versailles that focuses on that palace. They then build enormous gardens that reinforce the palace, and then he invites the crowned heads of Europe to visit. They're impressed as hell. They all go home and try to imitate Versailles, and the monarchy in France becomes the premier monarchy in Europe. Politics has a subtext of architecture. For a few minutes here, we're going to, if you just get a sense of how that permeates everything in a culture, then let's look at a couple of particular instances where we can see a culture embodied in a piece of architecture, where maybe we've preserved that house like this one, where you can go see it and you can feel, you can experience what that culture was like by the nature of the architecture. This is the Bishop's Palace in Galveston. The architect was Nicholas Clayton. It was done in the latter part of the 19th century. This house is open to the public. You can go and visit it anytime. Anybody been to the Bishop's Palace? A few. Definitely worth a trip. So this was built by the Gresham family. Mr. Gresham was a merchant. And in the latter part of the 19th century, Galveston was by far the largest and most affluent city in Texas. It was a port, and it was extremely successful port. It was a place where people from all over the world sent goods. It was a very cosmopolitan place. There were people from Europe and people from Asia, and it was a really lively, affluent, very successful city economically. And Mr. Gresham was a merchant, so he was thriving in this mercantile environment. And Mr. Gresham went all over the world, and he, when he would travel, he sometimes would find whole pieces like this fireplace that he found, and he said, "Wow, I love that fireplace. Let's dismantle it, put it in one of my ships, and send it back to Galveston. I'm going to tell my architect, find a place for this in the house." So just as Galveston was this eclectic place that was collecting people from all over the world, the house became this eclectic place where things were being collected from all over the world and put together in this house. You see the affluence. You see the kind of bravado, the headstrong, entrepreneurial quality of Galveston and Mr. Gresham in this kind of wild, crazy, just, you know, over-the-top kind of architecture that's there. It also is laying down roots. This was, you know, the beginning of Texas. And for once, now there begins to be an economy that is strong, and they're making a big, strong stone building. Not these little temporary buildings like they'd been doing 20 or 30 years before, but now something that's built to last. And in fact, a building that did survive, the hurricane of 1900, that devastated the older parts of Galveston. But this building survived because it said in bricks and mortar, it said, "We're here to stay. We're making a great culture here." There also are some just kind of sweet, interesting, nostalgic things. Mrs. Gresham, they had like 10 kids or something, a bunch of kids. She painted a portrait of every child somewhere in the house. So this kind of sweetness and family orientation. And you see in the little artifacts they collect, this nostalgia and this sweetness in the house, that beautiful chandelier made out of flowers, or the flowers painted in the lavatory. All the way through the house, you get the sense of the personality of these people, their sweetness, their family orientation, but you also get the personality of this time and this era and this place of headstrong, blustery, bravado, devil-may-care, you know, here-to-stay kind of culture. And it's embodied in the architecture. So that's one Texas house. We can get a sense of what Texas culture was in the latter part of the 19th century. This is a very different Texas house. This one was built here in Austin in the late 1960s, and it too lets us have a window into a very different piece of Texas culture. So in the late 1960s, this was kind of the hippie rebellion, and there was just a lot of counterculture rebellion going on. And Austin, of any city in Texas, was the most liberal and the most kind of into this rebellion. And there were attitudes about, you know, new lifestyles, new dress codes, people wearing their hair long, you know, hippie dresses, you know, new moral attitudes, you know, free sex, free drugs. There was a sense somehow there's going to be a revolution. And all these, anybody over 40 is like, you know, screw them. We're taking over here, and we're changing everything. So, for example, why should we have a roof and walls? Why should we make houses out of stone or brick or wood? That's stupid. That's old, traditional stuff. We're going to do revolutionary things. We're going to make this out of sprayed styrofoam. We're just going to make these wild shapes out of metal and rebar, and then we're going to spray onto it this plastic, and we're going to make these. And why in the world should we have like three bedrooms, two baths? That's stupid. That's like old traditional stuff. No, we're doing completely different, just flowing spaces. No rooms, just flowing spaces. And we'll just inhabit them in a very loose and creative kind of way. And everything needs to integrate with the landscape and be a part of nature and organic, because we're hippies and we love nuts and berries and natural lifestyle, and screw the corporate, you know, bad guys, you know, the pigs, you know, anyway, we're revolutionaries. And the house had all that ambiance to it. It also is kind of delicate and ephemeral, not built to last, kind of frail. And in fact, it didn't last. Turns out that the ultraviolet light deteriorated the polystyrene foam, and so it started self-destructing the minute it was built. It also turned out to be on land in Westlake that immediately became very valuable land for commercial development, and so it got torn down and a shopping center got put in its place. And in a way, all those values of those hippies, that kind of happened too, didn't it? I mean, maybe like your grandparents who, you see this photograph of them, flowers in their hair, hippies, and then they turned out to, oh yeah, I became a banker. It was ephemeral. It didn't last. But wow, what an amazing representation of that culture is here in the Foam House by Charles Harker in 1969. Now, in this class, we're going to look at some very famous pieces of architecture and monuments of the history of architecture. But honestly, we're not going to look at them as some, you know, something to talk about at a cocktail party. Man, I know the Parthenon backward forward. You just asked me a question. Yes, its origins in Pestum, 100 years earlier in its late Greek Ionic style. We're not going to be talking about that. Like I said, our definition of architecture is a physical embodiment of who we are as individuals and who we are collectively as a culture. And we're going to be looking at architecture as that. And you can look at the Parthenon and you can get amazing messages about the culture that produced it. So the Parthenon was built in Athens in 447 to 430 BC. Greek culture had been around for centuries at that time. For example, the first Olympic Games were like 780 BC. So 300 years before this, they had already established the Olympic Games. This was a very mature culture, very prominent, very refined kind of culture. But in 480 BC, a little bit before this, the Persians came and sacked Rome and burned the Acropolis. So this whole piece of the town was devastated. Then the Greeks retaliated and beat the Persians up again and became the rulers of the world again. But then it was time to rebuild the Acropolis, this very important part of Athens. And Pericles was the leader who did this. And so he's facing a situation where we've got a very mature culture and we want to build the embodiment of that culture. And he took all the resources of the entire kingdom. He brought craftspeople from all over his empire. For the Greeks, public spaces were very, very important, much more important than their private homes. So this became a real important destiny of Greek culture at the time. Now, think of Greek culture. It was, in many ways, the birth of mathematics, of science. They were the first culture to really look deeply into that. It also was the beginning of philosophy and logic. And if you look at the Parthenon, you see this representation of engineering, mathematics, order, clarity, logic, in this very symmetrical, very refined, very clear architectural expression. There even is, they began to understand at this time that what happens in your eye is that an image comes in and it shines on your retina, and that the retina is curved because the eyeball is curved. And so they thought that if we make a slight reverse curve in the long lines of the Parthenon, it will make it appear even more straight than straight. So they're seeking this kind of absolute precision, everything just right. This is the Greek mind seeking order, seeking an understanding of the universe, seeking philosophy, logic, those kinds of things. We see it embodied in their building. But they also were the beginning of theater and drama. And there's something kind of bold and strong and dramatic in the building as well. and its scale and its grandeur and its monumentality certainly speak to another aspect of Greek culture too. Now, this is, I think, the most amazing way to understand architecture. What is it in the values of that culture? What is it in the values of these people that got embedded in the architecture of their place? And it wasn't just the sort of macro architecture, but it was also the detail. And actually, a lot of the detail of the Parthenon was snarfed away by the British in the 19th century and taken and put in museums in London. And so in the British Museum, you see what are called the Elgin marbles, which were all the ornament that were on the Parthenon originally. And there you see another kind of story, a story about their religion and mythology and about the gods and the interaction of the gods with human beings and their great myth stories, say, of the centaurs and the Greeks battling with the centaurs, with these devils that were always trying to upset the order of their human existence. It's also their stories in the marbles about everyday life, about managing their livestock, about selling things in the marketplaces. There's this wonderful representation in the building of what Greek life was like. The Parthenon can be just this dumb, stupid image that you memorize and say that's a famous piece of architecture. Or it can be this living, breathing thing where you can go and visit it and you can feel what the mind of the Greeks were like through this, maybe better than any kind of words can express. Another great monument of architecture, St. Peter's in Rome. Again, this is a very, very famous building. But in fact, I think it's incredibly meaningful as a representation of this period of history, a period when the popes in Rome had incredible power. So the church was at that time not only the religious power, and it had the power of people's minds because it was the center of their religion, but also had enormous economic power. It was rich, rich, rich. They owned most of the land in the area, and many of the businesses were owned by the church. It also had enormous power in terms of politics. It was the government. It dominated the government in the way that sometimes Muslim religion is dominating other governments in parts of the world today. So here is this concentration of religious power, political power, economic power, all in the popes of Rome. And they wanted to express that power. They wanted to show people how dominant religion was meant to be in the world. And they made this crazy, wild, warring place. The scale is just enormous. Look at the slide on the left. How many of you have been to St. Peter's? Blow you away scale. My God, it's just immense inside there. And it lets you know, I'm this tiny creature in the midst of religion, which is much bigger than me. And dramatic and dynamic. Now, that again is a representation of a period of history in the world. Now, today, we build buildings all around us. And what do they say about us? Here's a building built 20 years ago in San Antonio. What does it say about San Antonio as maybe a place based in Hispanic culture to some extent? Sort of a tomato red color, moments where you feel like you might be on a small walled street in a Mexican town. How is that a representation of a piece of what San Antonio is? And yet this isn't like ye olde colonial architecture. It's very progressive. It's very modern. What does that say about San Antonio as roots in Hispanic culture, but now also moving to the future and very bold and dynamic? What does it also say about the role of a library in the community and this kind of social rooms and exhibit rooms and as a place for learning and a symbol of education? Every building we can look around at in our culture, there are messages like this to be had. Okay, time for a Twitter card question. So get out your 3x5 card. And in a very, very brief way, I want you to look at sort of your own background in architecture. And I want you to tell me, I'll give you three options. One is, you know, I have always understood how important architecture is. And I or my family have really used architecture as a tool to make our lives better. And this is an example of how that happened. That's option number one. I get it with architecture. All my life, it's been a part and a very clear part of the quality of life. Or number two, you know, I've always felt like architecture had something to it and that it was compelling, but honestly, I never understood it and I never really used it. And tell me about that. Or the third option is, I was freaking clueless. I mean, I've never paid any attention to it. I've just been oblivious. Maybe it has had a big influence, but I haven't been conscious of it at all. So tell me your own background or reaction to architecture over the 18, 20, 25 years you've been living in architecture.